You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Ballots are being mailed out to voters across the state, and top of the ticket is the race for California governor. We're continuing our series of conversations with the Democrat and Republican gubernatorial candidates. Up next is Katie Porter. The former Congress member served in the House for three terms and ran an unsuccessful Senate campaign back in 2024. Now, the Democrat is the only woman in a crowded race of candidates vying to become the next leader of the Golden State. I sat down with Porter on the heels of an endorsement from the McClatchy, California editorial board, which includes the Sacramento Bee, Modesto Bee, Fresno Bee, Merced Sun Star, and Tribune of San Luis Obispo. We talked about what sets her apart from the five other Democrats in this race, as well as her first priorities in office if elected. Former Congresswoman Porter, thank you so much for taking the time here on Insight.
Excited to talk with you.
So you are a three-time Congress member, as well as a lawyer and a law professor. Let's just start from the get-go. What drew you to politics?
Well, I ran for Congress after Donald Trump's first election. It wasn't my first experience in public service. For 3 years before that, I ran a statewide foreclosure prevention, eviction prevention program at the invitation of then Attorney General, now former Vice President Kamala Harris, and so worked across the state to help families who've been victimized by predatory lending. And so a lot of my career had been about affordability, about housing costs. And after Donald Trump got elected, I knew we were in for a world of hurt. And so I flipped a seat in Orange County that had been held by a Republican for 75 years. But it was really about recognizing that if we just keep doing the same old stuff Democrats had been doing, and we keep electing the same old people, we're going to end up with more of Trump. And I think that's exactly, sadly, where we find ourselves now in the Trump 2 presidency.
Aside from being the top state position in California, what attracts you to being governor?
Governors have the ability to make sure government is working in ways that are different from being in the legislature. And so when the legislature has an idea or they go to tackle a problem, they need to have a partnership with the governor. You can have the best idea in the whole world, but if you have an administration or a budget or personnel that is not on board, then your idea will not actually help people. You'll have had a press conference about your law, but your law will not have changed people's lives. And that really came home to me when I was in Congress early in the coronavirus pandemic, maybe a month in, and I was questioning the director, Trump's director of the CDC. And I was like the 47th or 48th person, the very last person to question over this two-day hearing. And I asked him to use an existing law, didn't have to make a law, didn't have to take a vote, use an existing law to make COVID testing free. And I got him to agree to do it. That was such a powerful moment of helping people in a time when so many people were scared. And it really drove home, you don't always need to pass more laws. Sometimes you need somebody who will actually make the laws we've got effective.
Well, given that for a congressional district, which is home to, on average, roughly 750,000 residents, it's different from statewide office. As governor, you're making decisions on behalf of, 40 million Californians. So how does all of your experience make you the right fit to make those decisions for California?
Yeah, I mean, look, one of the things about representing Orange County is that you learn to deal with people with differences of opinion. So I represented about a third Democrats, about a third no party preference independents, about a third Republicans. And so you've really seen Orange County sort of grow and change. We are building housing in Orange County. We do have excellent infrastructure in Orange County. We do have excellent schools in Orange County. And so there's also, like, I'm part of a model of California that in many ways, people in a lot of our other places and cities feel like we've lost. So Orange County is now the sixth most populous county in the U.S., San Diego County, the fifth most populous county in the whole United States. But politically, these places don't get a lot of attention. I grew up in a rural area. I grew up outside of a very poor farming community. And so I think a lot about how do I connect with all of the parts of California? And I think that's going to be key to how we're going to grow our state, is really investing in making sure everyone in California, across our state, urban and rural, Democrat, Republican, can afford to live here.
Turning to our current governor, how do you view Governor Newsom's two terms in office? Is there anything specific that you would do differently?
People approach politics personally. How did it affect them? And as a single mom of three teenagers, I'll tell you what Governor Newsom did that really helped me. First, he made school meals free. And so as a mom, I get about $345 a month in child support. And I was spending about $300 a month on school lunch. And so when he made school lunch free, that really doubled the amount of help I was getting raising my kids. And it meant that my kids didn't have to worry if I forgot to add lunch money about getting the special lunch, meaning the lunch for kids who can't pay. And the second thing he did is make community college free. Two free years of community college. It's called the California Promise. As somebody who's, you know, got like one kid who's in college now, another one who's a high school junior, one who's an eighth grader, that is real money that it is saving my family. It's a major reason for families to stay in California, for young people to want to come here, people thinking about starting a family, come to California and get free college. And I'm building on that with two tuition-free years at our UCs, our CSUs, or our Cal Polys. When I'm governor, California will offer something no other state does to every single resident of the state, a tuition-free college degree. And I'm able to do that in part building on what Governor Newsom did with free community college.
When you take a critical eye to his last two terms, is there anything that doesn't sit well with you?
One of the things I would say is that we can't let affordability. This is a general comment, I think, about Sacramento in this moment. You know, kind of this idea that there's a tension between affordability and standing up for consumers and workers and families. And there's actually not. So, for example, with regard to energy, we need to be investing much more in renewable energy. Why? Because renewable energy is cheaper. And Trump's unlawful war in Iran is really illustrating that, why we can't depend on foreign oil, foreign sources of energy. We need to be doing it here, and we can do it with green energy. That will be cheaper. I give Governor Newsom a lot of credit for talking about housing and understanding that housing is a policy choice. We are making policy choices in California that are driving up the cost of housing. But I think we need to be much quicker now. The next governor really has an opportunity to accelerate the policies and really get those houses built that he talked about. We still need the houses that he talked about us needing, those 3 million homes. But we got to build much, much faster. And that is also key to how we bring down the cost of housing, is building it faster.
Yeah, California, regularly by leaders of the state, gets touted as the fourth or fifth largest economy, a leader on many fronts. But there's a lot of Californians who are just frustrated with how the state of, I guess, the cost of living and affordability in California. It is a high burden for too many Californians to shoulder. You, of course, are known for using a whiteboard while in Congress. You ask difficult questions. You hold powerful companies and people to account. So in that same spirit of that whiteboard, what are California leaders getting wrong for those Californians who feel cost burdened and wondering where their taxes are going and if it's being spent efficiently?
Yeah, so I've rolled out a policy to eliminate California state income taxes for those earning less than $100,000. And I think Democrats and Sacramento establishment for too long have seen taxes as only a one-way ratchet. We all have to pay more. Now, maybe the rich pay even more. But really, we can do something to give Californians who are struggling to make ends meet more money every single paycheck by eliminating California state income taxes. That really does help. And we know that when you give people more of their own paycheck, they make good choices with it. They buy healthier food. They cater a little emergency savings cushion. They're able to put their kids in an after-school program. And so that is a real policy where I think Democrats have gotten into this attitude that we just keep creating programs, more programs, bigger programs, more, more, more. But sometimes the best solution is actually to let people keep more of what they earn.
Well, at the heart of California's financial challenges at the legislature and just funding, California has just some dramatic pendulum swings when it comes to the state budget. And the state has been riding out budget shortfalls following those record surpluses from the pandemic. So there were expanded services like Medi-Cal. Those have been paused, alongside unprecedented investments in homelessness response, billions of dollars in state funding. And in addition, compounding all of this, there's federal funding cuts from the Trump administration. If you're elected governor come January, you release your budget proposal for the upcoming fiscal year. How would the state work within its means? Like, what's currently missing? Is there anything you would cut? And if you are going to add programs like free childcare, adding on to tuition-free college, realistically, how do you make these work within these dramatic swings of the state budget?
Yep. So I think you have to have priority choices. You cannot promise people everything. We're just not in that budget moment. And we don't have a president in Donald Trump. We have an unreliable federal partner. So we're not in a moment where we can have everything, which means you have to make priority choices. And I want our governor to be someone who understands affordability, who pushes a shopping cart, who fills up a minivan with 180,000 miles. I think it's hard for a billionaire to really get what Californians are going through on affordability, for example. It's hard for people who are of a different generation to understand the housing challenges that this group of young Californians are facing, for example. So priority choices. I would look at every dollar going into the budget and ask this question. Is this an investment of our tax dollars? Where if we spend this money 3 years, 3 months, 6 years, 2 days, will we have more? So, for example, keeping kids fed is a great investment, right? School meals have healthier kids, they have quieter classrooms, you get better academic achievement. We're spending that money today and we're getting something back tomorrow. Funding for our state universities, infrastructure, green energy, these things pay back. And then there's spending. There's the stuff you do, like you buy the iced latte, you drink it, you probably could have had a glass of water and you would have been about the same. That's the stuff that we have to look really hard at. And so I want to protect those investments. For example, in healthcare, we're projected to lose 25% of our hospitals because of Donald Trump's healthcare cuts. You have to protect hospitals because when a hospital closes, not only is a community less healthy, but you're losing the pharmacy, you're losing the physical therapist, you're losing the doctors, all the things that surround a hospital. And so you have to really think about what are the things that are really hard. When we have a better budget year, there are some things you can put back. There's some stuff that if you lose it, you never get it back. And hospitals, schools, people who leave our state, it's very hard to get them back. Look what's happened with the film industry. California just kind of like, though, who knows? Maybe we should help Hollywood. And didn't. Now that industry has so much of it is exited, it's much harder and much more expensive to get it back. So that would be the lens that I would look at every single dollar. And taxpayers should expect that kind of accountability from Democrats, both in the legislature and as their next governor.
Do you have an example of one of those latte investments, those $10 lattes where, you know, they sound really good, they taste really good, but, you know, if you have to like rein in on your budget, you can go without it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I thought about this with homelessness to some degree because, look, permanent supportive housing is really important to help people who have been on the streets, sometimes for years, to come in off the streets and get the services they need. But it costs a lot to do per person. It can cost $750,000, $750,000, even $1 million to build those units and fund them. Homelessness prevention, the typical cost to keep someone from being evicted is $7,000, $6,500. Wow. That is a lot more bang for our buck. So I do think we have to start thinking about how do we get ahead of some problems? Because if not, even though we're fixing the problem's growing just as fast as we're fixing it. And I think that's why people feel frustrated about homelessness. So I also think we can have some efficiencies in terms of instead of having 62 different programs to help people with healthcare costs. Like, can we consolidate and focus on something like our own prescription drug programs, CalRx? Like, we're the nation's fourth largest economy. You said it yourself, Vicki. Everyone likes to talk about that. Let's act like it and actually drive down costs by using our size to get a better deal for taxpayers.
As you laid out, you stand in strong opposition to President Trump and his policies, but are there any avenues where you could work with his administration to the benefit of California?
Well, you hope so. You hope that you will see the president treat California in an even-handed way and not act like we're, you know, just a place for him to go put political punishment, right? To punish us. We've seen too much of that. We've seen it with wildfire funding, for example. So I hope that President Trump respects everything that California adds to the economy adds to the United States and treats us equally to every other state. We have some special needs that we have here in California, like wildfire prevention. We also have some amazing things that we send to the federal government and contribute to the economy, like the largest tax base. And so I would say, like, I will go in and say to President Trump, here's what California needs. We need to bring down the cost of housing. Is that something we can cooperate on? At the same time, Vicky, if what he does is come for Californians, he's coming straight through me, and I will not back down on that.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio, and if you're just joining us, I'm talking with former Representative Katie Porter, a Democratic candidate for governor. So early on in the race last year, your behavior was in the spotlight. Videos surfaced of you yelling at a staffer, walking out of an interview with a reporter. You've addressed this on multiple occasions, even on the debate stage as well. But just taking a step back to the reaction, do you think the public criticism was fair?
So look, I have acknowledged that those weren't good moments. So absolutely, people should hold me to account. I also don't think that they tell the entire story. I'd in fact stayed in that interview and continued and answered every question and continued that interview for 20 minutes. I did not in fact leave. And the staffer that I got frustrated with, most importantly, I apologized to her 5 years ago when that incident happened. And so it is absolutely important to take responsibility for your behavior and to do better. But we are also all bet more than the sum of a couple of bad moments. And I would encourage Californians to really think about, who have I shown them I am? Who do I fight? Who do I take on? I have taken on big banks. I have taken on big pharma. I've taken on big oil. And I've delivered things like free COVID testing. And so that, am I tough? Sure. Do I believe government should do better? Absolutely. And so I think you have to, you know, I'm really proud that 30 of my staffers, for example, on their own wrote a letter talking about that, yeah, I was a demanding boss, but I also believed in them. I cheered them on. I supported them in the professionally and in their personal challenges. And to me, that means the world, that those people who knew me best know exactly what kind of leader I was.
California has not had a female governor. Do you think the bar is higher because you're a woman?
Oh, I mean, look, I think you just asked this question, Vicky. Like, I have apologized hundreds of times now for these two incidents that have been characterized in ways that I think are globalizing a situation. And it's, appropriate that I apologize. But on some level, the main sort of hit against me seems to be that I'm somehow, quote, not likable. And that is exactly what people said about every female elected official who we've ever had. People said that stuff about the late Senator Feinstein when she ran. They said it about Senator Barbara Boxer. They said it about, I could go on, Elizabeth Warren. They said it about Kamala Harris. It's a trope. And so I think every woman has had bad moments and known they can do better. Every person has had bad moments and knows they could do better. I've taken responsibility. And I think in this race, when we have seen some men called to task, asked to account for their decisions, for example, how they handled the migrant child crisis in the case of Secretary Becerra, decisions to invest in fossil fuel in the case of Mr. Steyer, Mr. Swalwell and the sexual assault allegations, there hasn't been a level of taking responsibility. There's been efforts to say that was the past. That was a long time ago. And so I think that what I've shown voters here in a very real way is what kind of leader I am. And I am a leader who's not going to dodge the issue, who's going to look you in the eye, apologize, promise to do better, and then actually do better.
In the last minute or so that we have, I mean, this race is unusual. So many leading candidates, 6 Democrats, 2 Republicans who regularly poll at the top. How does this dynamic shape how you campaign and get your message across to voters?
Yeah, so I mean, I think our communication with voters, including the new ads that we've just released, they show that I am not, in fact, like most politicians. And I think that is a good thing in this moment. If we keep electing the same people we always have, right? People who have lives really different from us, people who've been in politics for 30 or 40 years, we're probably going to get the same things we've always gotten. And for me, as a mom who's thinking about how are my kids going to find jobs in a world full of AI, are these kids ever going to be able to buy homes? And not, I don't want them living on my couch. And so we're showing that in our ads. And so really talking about what it's like, why I'm different, and showing that I get the affordability crisis. And unlike some, I don't take corporate donations. I'm not beholden to corporations. I don't take their PAC money. And therefore, you can trust me to not only get your life, but you can trust that I will fight to make it better.
Are you concerned that two Republicans could advance to the November general election?
With Donald Trump endorsing one of the Republican candidates, I think we've seen pretty steady gap there between one Republican and the other. There's been ups and downs, as you mentioned, different polls finding different things on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, I think we pretty much know we're going to have this one Republican. And I think the remaining three Democrats should, you know, Californians deserve a choice. We're a majority Democratic state. We should have three or four choices of Democrats to consider for this election, and I'm going to work hard to earn every Californian's vote.
Finally, this week, you received an endorsement from the Sacramento Bee, the editorial board, along with the other McClatchy papers, the Fresno Bee, the Modesto Bee, Merced Sun Star, the Tribune of San Luis Obispo. The headline calls you an underdog, which feels a little ironic given your national profile, your background in Congress. Do you feel like an underdog in this race?
What I would say is that there's a lot of yearning in this race for somebody else to figure out who it's going to be. Like, shouldn't Sacramento just figure out who's going to be governor? And so I do think, like, somebody like me who's willing to push at Sacramento, who's not going to take lobbyist money, who isn't beholden to corporations, yeah, in the world that the Sacramento Bee lives in, I think that feel that kind of anti-establishment, I'll do things that I think are best, not I'll do things because they're the best ideas. I'll do things on principle, not because I'm bought and paid for. That is an underdog position in the sense that the vast majority of our legislature, every prior governor we've ever had is not only, you know, in the case of governors, they're not only men, but they're people who take corporate contributions. And so in that sense, having a grassroots funded campaign, being able to raise the money to get up on TV and show Californians who we are, I do think it's something different. It's something to overcome, and it's something that gives California a real opportunity to get a governor who's going to deliver a better life for them.
Representative Porter, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much.
That is my interview with former Representative Katie Porter, a Democratic candidate for governor. You can find our ongoing series of gubernatorial candidate interviews on our website at capradio.org/govrace. Still ahead, it's the time of year where local artists shoot for the stars to get that coveted spot on NPR's Tiny Desk. We'll listen to some of the contest submissions from our backyard. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.